This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, we hear from Samoa's Prime Minister on an ambitious 11-point declaration signed by Pacific countries with the United States.
The Pacific, of course, are very much prioritising climate change.
And a senior PNG government minister has launched a scathing attack on Australia, accusing it of harbouring an alleged fraudster in Cairns.
For him to be able to remain in Australia to avoid prosecution, I would say it is unacceptable.
We'll also be joined by Island Music's Rick Howe to find out the latest on reggae, dancehall and rhythm beats out there in the region. That's all coming up. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
First, though, the United States has been dealt a blow in its efforts to improve relations with the Pacific Island countries and counter China's efforts to exert more influence in the region. As President Joe Biden prepares to host a White House summit with Pacific leaders, Solomon Islands is already making it clear it won't sign up to a proposed new pact. Marion Farr has this exclusive report.
It's an agreement that covers everything from climate change to economic development.
Strengthening our partnership, bolstering Pacific regionalism, tackling climate change as a big priority.
The president of the Federated States of Micronesia, David Panuelo, says the 11-point declaration between the United States and Pacific Island nations sets out key priorities for the relationship.
Enhancing our cooperation and advancing economic growth and sustainable development in the Pacific. We are committed to supporting each other to prepare and respond to natural disasters.
The White House wants to clinch the agreement at a meeting with Pacific leaders in Washington this week, but not everyone is on board. Solomon Islands has indicated it won't sign up because it wants more time to consider it. That's likely to increase anxieties in the US and Australia, where there are growing concerns about a deepening relationship between Solomon Islands and China. The ABC has approached the Solomon Islands government for comment, but hasn't received a response. While several sources have stressed that negotiations over the joint declaration are still ongoing, Samoan Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa says she supports it.
It's a developing, I think, opportunity for the region.
She says it bears some resemblance to a more sweeping trade and security deal China sought with 10 Pacific nations in May.
I mean, they're similar in the intent, you know, of the proposing party, which, you know, in this instance is the US and China as well.
The Chinese deal was shelved over concerns that some Pacific states had been excluded from discussions.
We've been insisting that if partners wish to talk to us collectively, then they need to do it through the modalities of the Pacific Forum.
It's criticism the White House has also faced. Cook Islands, Niue, New Caledonia and French Polynesia initially weren't invited to this week's presidential summit. Samoa's PM was among leaders who urged the US to reconsider the guest list, which it did, extending invites to all members of the Pacific Islands Forum.
When the Chinese were proposing something similar, we were giving them that message, but it didn't seem to filter through, or they weren't willing to take that on board.
Director of the Lowy Institute's Pacific Islands program, Dr. Meg Keane, says the real test goes beyond signing an agreement.
There has been promises, in fact, on a number of these type of topics in the past, and there hasn't been strong deliveries.
Palau President Sarangal Whips Jr. agrees.
I like the hope that it's just not a photo op at the White House and then that's the end of it. I mean, I hope it's substantial programs and initiatives that really build that partnership.
For now, the White House is just hoping to get a Pacific seal of approval for its new policy direction.
And that report was from Marion Farr and Stephen Judgetts. And as we just heard, one Pacific nation that is supporting the 11-point declaration with the United States is Samoa. Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa explains why.
The Pacific, of course, are very much prioritizing climate change. We're very keen on the development that has been going on for decades now for the multidimensional vulnerability index. you know, which puts a different lens, you know, especially taking into account the specificities of small island states and their vulnerabilities. So here at the UN, we've been advocating very strongly about that. And we should, you know, take up the opportunity while we're talking to the Americans to garner their support for the endorsement at the UN of the MBI, because that's very important to the SIDS, small island developing states. Of course, the security issues will come up, especially maritime securities with the, you know, our particular focus on the ocean, not only the protection, you know, of the fisheries, but also the maritime boundaries.
You mentioned, you touched on the topic of security there, and I know that that's been a big interest to many sort of countries lately. Are you open to the US playing a more active role as a defence partner with Pacific countries?
Well, I'm not so sure about defence. Well, it's more about, you know, security in the terms of protections of maritime assets. You know, when you begin to talk about defence, you know, you're sort of looking at scenarios where, you know, other, you know, countries or forces will be coming into the Pacific. We don't see it that way. We wouldn't like to encourage that in any way. You know, sovereignty is very important. There are arrangements around regional security that have been going on for, you know, many decades. But that's the way we're viewing security issues. I mean, of course, you know, there have been a lot of talk about the situation in Solomon Islands. But, you know, I think Solomon Islands has a particular set of conditions that, you know, many of us in the Pacific don't have. It's probably something, you know, that has to be worked through.
How similar is this declaration with the region-wide deal that China was seeking with 10 Pacific nations earlier this year? Are the two comparable?
Yeah, they're similar in the intent, you know, of the proposing party, which, you know, in this instance is the US, and with China as well. But I think the point that we are wanting to make, and you know, at least the Americans have worked through with us, you know, to quite a large extent, probably not fully, about, you know, what's the modality of our meeting. So we've been insisting that if partners wish to talk to us collectively, then they need to do it through the modalities of the Pacific Forum. Now, when the Chinese were proposing something similar, we were giving them that message, but it didn't seem to filter through, or, you know, they weren't willing to take that on board. Mind you, the Chinese were trying to do this whilst most of us were in lockdown. So, you know, it was very much virtual, whereas this one is taking place face to face, you know, because borders have opened up. There has been, you know, a negotiated build up to the meeting where, you know, the positioning has been going backwards and forwards between the US side and the Pacific side.
And you've really sort of pressed, I guess, or expressed the importance of Pacific regionalism, but I'm wondering about your thoughts on how that's sort of come under strain recently. And at the UNGA, we saw the president of Kiribati say something along the lines of his concern about, you know, regionalism being used to serve the interests of certain players. What are your thoughts about those sorts of comments?
The forum went through a process of rebuilding the relationship with the Northern Territories, who had started the process of leaving the forum. But then, you know, there was a process of reconciling, and all of the Northern members, with the exception of Kiribati, have returned to the forum. Now, that's unfortunate, but it happens, you know. I mean, I don't think, you know, anywhere with these types of regional arrangements, you know, that there are perfect situations as we might want them to be. And I think Kiribati has a particular set of, you know, issues themselves that, you know, they need to work through.
What does the United States need to show that this is a genuine partnership and that it's a genuine partner to the Pacific? And what role do you expect the US to play in coming years?
Well, I think at the outset, hearing, you know, just on this issue of how they should work with us collectively. So, you know, that, I mean, that's really important to us. And they've been able to demonstrate that they've heard us. They had particular ideas of how they wanted to work with us. You know, we've had the backwards and forwards. So I think the expectation would be that there is better understanding between parties, you know, that we can really identify common interests, you know, because everyone talks about each country's interests and so forth. Well, you know, at some point and on, you know, different issues, that's what you need to find. What is it that you have in common?
That was Samoa's Prime Minister Fiame Naomi Mataafa speaking there to ABC's Marion Farr.
Hold the front page!
You know what that sound means. It does say hold the front page, but we're actually finding out what's making news digitally, usually on online around the Pacific. And to do that, I'm joined, as always, by reporter Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka.
And now let's start in Papua New Guinea, where the government is being threatened to be locked out of its offices, its physical offices, I take it. What's happening?
Yeah, a bit of a funny one, this one. The tables have turned in some ways, but Papua New Guinea's largest superannuation fund has threatened to lock government employees out of office spaces if the government doesn't settle some of its unpaid rent. So that's according to newspaper The National, who spoke to the chairman of the number one super fund. His name is Reg Managi, and he said the lockouts would start immediately if the government doesn't cough up the money they owe.
And how much is that money that they owe?
So it's a fair bit. So the chairman says the government is owed about, they're owed about a US $44 million just in back rent alone, and the government had so far allocated about a US $70 million to reduce some of its debt in its most recent budget for the year. So he's asking that that the money from that budget gets used to settle some of that long overdue rent because there's been too many broken commitments over the years.
Well, that's interesting stuff. Now let's head to Tuvalu, where two World War II bombs have been... Oh, no, not two, but from World War II, sorry. huge bombs have been found. What's that about?
Yeah, much more than two. So 22 500-pound...
I thought it was just one, but no.
No, 22 500-pound bombs have been found underwater in a place called Nunamia. And so it was found by a joint naval team from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States, and was reported by RNZ. And it comes after the Tuvalu government actually asked the ADF to look for explosive remnants from the war. It's an extension of Operation Render Safe, which is a mission we've been carrying out within Solomon Islands, mainly over the last sort of decade or so. Obviously, we've encountered a lot of bombs over in the Solomon Islands, but plenty more throughout the Pacific, it looks like, as well.
Yes, and when it comes to those bombs that and unexploded ordnances, I think is the official term, that they find in Solomon Islands, sometimes they do go off and cause injuries. Is there a risk of that happening in Tuvalu as well?
Yeah, look, I guess there's always a risk, no matter how long they might have been laying dormant. As it pertains to these 22 bombs, they haven't been disarmed yet. However, now that they've been found, preparations can be made to safely dispose of them, which they're planning to do in 2023.
Yes, 2023, so some time. But yes, hopefully people aren't swimming around that area where the bombs are. Now, to some sporting news. Papua New Guinea has defeated Fiji in MSG Prime Minister's Cup semi-finals. What's happened?
Yeah, so this is the rebranded Melanesian Cup, which has been taking place over the past couple of weeks. So a 23rd-minute goal from a penalty was all it took for PNG to get over the Digicel Bulla Boys, 1-0. Fiji had their chances, led by Roy Krushna, but failed to capitalise on a few scoring chances in the second half, unfortunately. It's the second time this year that Fiji has gone down to PNG as well. They lost 2-1 back in March at the FIFA World Cup Qatar Oceania qualifier. And now PNG will take on Vanuatu in the final on Friday. And Vanuatu, lucky to get there as well. They only beat Solomon Islands in a penalty shootout, I believe, a couple of days ago.
Oh, wow. So the match on Friday, we'll see what happens at that finals. Thank you, Kyle, for those news stories from around the region.
Thanks, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us the latest from around the Pacific. But don't go anywhere. We've still got some more stories for you right here on Pacific Beat. Coming up, we'll find out why a senior Papua New Guinea government minister and its national police force have attacked Australia's anti-corruption credentials in the Pacific.
For him to be able to remain in Australia to avoid prosecution, I would say it is unacceptable.
And we'll be joined by Rick Howe, host of Island Music, who'll be sharing some of the latest tunes out of, well, Solomon Islands, and also this very interesting one. Do stay tuned for this, because it's a track of Spanish and Swiss reggae. How does that sound? Well, coming up, you'll find out.
Celebrate the pride of the Pacific.
You know, we're proud of our country and our heritage.
Stay up to date with all the latest sporting news.
So emotional every time you go out there and you sing the national anthem.
And hear inspiring stories from some of the Pacific's finest athletes.
I've grown so much confidence within myself, and I never thought I would be the player that I am today.
Watch That Pacific Sports Show, Wednesday nights at 7 PNG time on ABC Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host of Pacific Beat, Priyanka Srinivasan. And a senior PNG government minister and the National Police Force have launched a scathing attack on Australia's anti-corruption credentials in the Pacific, accusing it of harbouring an alleged fraudster in Cairns. For 18 months, PNG has been asking the Australian government to extradite Cairns resident Samson Juby, who's accused of conspiring to embezzle more than $100 million from a fund set aside for impoverished landowners. Here's Sean Rubenstein Dunlop from ABC Investigations.
That's great stuff. Lauren Brown, Tungai for the corner. Togo reaches out and scores.
Rugby league diplomacy was on display in Brisbane on the weekend as the Prime Minister's 13 took on PNG.
James Marape from Papua New Guinea and Anthony Albanese from Australia.
Watching on was PNG's Immigration Minister Brian Cramer, but he had more than footy on his mind. He's spoken to the ABC about confidential negotiations with Australia over a wanted man who's refusing to surrender.
It is something that we're extremely frustrated about. We would not expect this degree of delay in getting a response in an issue that should be rather straightforward.
For 18 months, PNG has asked Australia to extradite Cairns resident and PNG citizen Samson Juby, who's a chief suspect in one of the biggest fraud cases in the country's legal history. He's accused of conspiring to embezzle more than $100 million in funds set aside for tens of thousands of villagers affected by one of the world's worst mine disasters at the Ok-Tedi mine more than 20 years ago. Six people, including Australian lawyer Greg Shepherd, are scheduled to stand trial in PNG in 2 weeks. But Brian Cramer says Australia's no closer to a decision on Samson Juby.
For him to be able to remain in Australia to avoid prosecution, I would say it is unacceptable that it has taken the Australian Attorney General's department up to 18 months to make a firm position on a request for an extradition without actually saying that we have not met the standard requirements of Australia's legislation. And today we continue to wait for 18 months. That may go on for 2 years.
The ABC tracked down Samson Juby to his home in Cairns. He refused an interview but fiercely maintains his innocence, saying he's the victim of a corrupt witch hunt. PNG's police force is also speaking out. In a statement to the ABC, it says, quote, "Australia's inability to assist in this most basic of legal processes does not sit well with its broader anti-corruption and security intentions in the region." That's a view shared by former Australian Federal Police Officer John Chevis. He's an expert on corruption and money laundering who's advised PNG law enforcement.
The process seems to be taking a very long time. Now, these sorts of mutual legal assistance requests are notoriously slow, but this is now being played out in a very different security environment to that which existed in our region a year ago. And Australia spends $500 million a year approximately in assisting Papua New Guinea. Quite a lot of that money is expended in assisting in these sorts of areas, the governance processes and the administration of justice. So to have these sorts of issues play out so slowly when it comes to actually putting the rubber to the road doesn't really serve Australia's interests in the best way possible.
The Australian Attorney General's Department, which is handling the extradition request, is declining to comment on what it calls confidential discussions. But a spokesperson says it aims to ensure proposed extradition requests fully comply with Australia's legal requirements to withstand any challenge.
And that was Sean Rubenstein-Dunlop from ABC Investigations with that story. You are tuned in to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat. Thank you so much for your company this Wednesday morning. And across most supermarkets these days, there's often a reasonable range of international cuisines available. At the very least, you'll find Chinese, Japanese, Indian, Mexican, and even British foods as you wander through the aisles. But finding native indigenous ingredients can be more challenging. And here in Australia, it's something Yamaji cook and reality TV star Matt Moncrief wants to change. He started a petition demanding Coles and Woolworths stock ingredients such as kakadu plums, lemon myrtle, bush tomatoes, and more. Reporter Bianca Carboni has the story.
Why isn't our food more readily available when it's, you know, eco-friendly, it's grown here, it's literally at our doorstep?
Matt Moncrief's passion for native foods was sparked as a child in Western Australia's Gascoyne region.
Growing up, I've always eaten native ingredients, traditional food, you know, like kangaroo tail, all the herbs, saltbush, pepperberry, all that kind of stuff. And when I left Carnarvon and when I left home, I found it really, really difficult to source my foods.
This year, Moncrief and his best friend became the first Aboriginal cuisine team in the history of Channel 7's My Kitchen Rules. Ever since, he's been flooded with questions about where to source native ingredients, but says most can only be found in small stores.
It would just be a lot easier if we could have it stocked in the supermarkets, because it's just every little town doesn't have, you know, a farmer's market with finger limes. We've got these aisles in the big supermarkets that stock, you know, all the international foods. You know, you can basically go and get these foods from the UK in a certain aisle, but you can't go and get our native ingredients.
In the past 2 weeks, Moncrief has collected over 4,000 signatures on his petition calling on Woolworths and Coles to stock more native products. He says it's time to celebrate native foods.
It'll be more available. I think culture will be a little bit more celebrated, and you could get interested in cooking with it. And I've seen so many and heard so many people say, Australia doesn't have a cuisine, basically. And I'm like, we do. You're sleeping on the oldest culture in the world. And we have foods and we have, you know, ingredients and we have bush medicine and we have all of that. And I'm just wondering why we don't have it in our supermarkets.
Celebrity chef and Bundjalung man Mark Olive agrees Australians have a unique opportunity to connect with Aboriginal culture through traditional foods.
We've got this amazing cuisine here that we just don't utilise. And let's face it, everybody's got a curry, everybody's got a, you know, a five spice in the cupboard, but We need this country to step up and having our own indigenous ingredients like the lemon myrtles, the wattle seeds, the river mints, the sea parsleys. And that's what I see as our national cuisine. You know, in the last 10 years, it's slowly coming around now. We've seen all of our cooking shows. It's starting to incorporate this stuff now. And I think it's going to take another good 5 years, 10 years, before this is going to be just like Vegemite in the cupboard.
Moncrief acknowledges there are logistical challenges in stocking native products on supermarket shelves.
It's a whole huge supply issue, but I think there's jobs and potential out there, and I think Coles and Woolies and these big supermarkets can make it happen.
A Coles spokesperson said the company was proud to sell products that contained native ingredients. Woolworths said it's always looking for more avenues to stock native Indigenous products, and it's open to conversations with more First Nations businesses and suppliers.
That was reporter Bianca Carboni with that story. You're tuned into Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Thank you so much for your company. Australian Opals veteran centre Kayla George is playing a big part for Australia during the Women's Basketball World Cup in Sydney. But the most important role of her life will be starting soon with the arrival of a baby girl. And she has her sister-in-law to thank for providing the ultimate gift in a special part of Torres Strait Islander law. Amanda Shalala has this story.
Kayla George and her husband have wanted a baby for some time. As a female athlete, that's not always easy. So she looked to her family for help to conceive a baby daughter.
Her name is Pearl. She's due on October 13. So my husband and I are really excited. Obviously, I'm not pregnant. So my husband is a Torres Strait Islander, and in their culture, for generations, island adoption has been very common. So essentially, if someone in the family has struggled to fall pregnant or is unable to fall pregnant, another family member can choose to gift a baby to that person. And in this case, my husband and I have been together 11 years. I have been playing basketball a lot. It's my job. So it's always been a challenge to find a time to fall pregnant. In saying that, I have had some difficulties with, you know, girly things as well. You know, I've had my struggles there. And as a female athlete, we put a lot of stress on our bodies. So there's some stuff we've got to work out, you know, when it's time to fall pregnant. So at this stage, I think I can still have my own. But we'll see when I'm finished playing basketball. Or I'll have a break at some point, maybe after the next Olympics, to have my own or to try and have my own. My husband's sister is gifting us with a beautiful baby girl that we are so excited about. And she will be our own. She's our daughter, and we cannot wait. We are just over the moon. And I feel like I'm cheating a little bit because I get to keep playing and I get to compete at a World Cup and then go home and pick up my daughter, like, you know, just out the birthing suite, then take her to Melbourne. And, like, I feel like I just, you know, life will keep going except I'll have this, you know, beautiful, gorgeous baby. So just overwhelmed with emotion. Again, hasn't probably kicked in like a lot of things, like, you know, home soil, World Cup, baby on the way, like, so I've got my pram ready, but I haven't picked it up yet, and I've, you know, got all her clothes sorted. I had to kind of, you know, break it up a little bit so that I wasn't overwhelmed with the thought of everything going on in my life, which I'm pretty good at doing. So I kind of just, yeah, left the pram to after, and the bottles and stuff are after, and I'll deal with that when I get home. But she's got some clothes ready, so, and some nappies and some wipes, so baby shower's good for that. But I'll have another baby shower in Melbourne, though, because, you know, more presents, obviously.
George's fertility journey started when she was 16. She went on the pill and stayed on it for 9 years.
So when I was, 24, 25, I stopped the pill. I didn't have a period for 4 years. And during that time, I'm like, you know, Rio Olympics, World Cup, like WNBA, WNBL, overseas seasons in Hungary, France. Like, I'm, you know, playing. I'm an elite athlete. And then it gets to a point where I was like, this isn't normal, probably around the 3-year mark. So I went and saw a specialist in Melbourne. And I can't exactly remember what he diagnosed me with, but it was essentially that I wasn't ovulating naturally, like by myself, like I wasn't able to ovulate. But I still had eggs in there. I had some polycystic ovaries, but not the syndrome. I don't know if that makes sense, but yep. So I was like, all right, cool. Let's just deal with that. And so I went on this treatment, and My specialist said it's like 1/10 of what he would give IVF users, so 1/10. So after the 2018 World Cup, I was on this treatment to try and fall pregnant. It was after the World Cup. We just won a silver medal in Tenerife, Spain. I was like, beautiful timing. We'd try and fall pregnant within that season in WNBL. It was my first year with the Melbourne Boomers. And then I'd have, you know, all timing works well. If we can have the pregnancy happen here, then I'd have enough time to, you know, calculating, making sure I didn't miss the next Olympics. And that's what it's like as an athlete. Like, what are we missing? What are we, like, what are we sacrificing as a female athlete? And so I did one round of it, and my specialist said 2 or 3 rounds, you'll find the most success. And with this treatment, you've got a high chance of having multiples. So I was like, oh, great, let's just pop out some twins, that'll be great. And I did one round of it. It knocked me for 6 with just the hormones and the needles in my belly, and it was pretty full on. I felt nauseous for like the entire 2018-19 season. I was like, I had lemon and ginger tea on the side of almost every practice. No one knew, but I was so nauseous and just like dealing with taking these. That was traumatic enough. Like I was, you know, on the phone crying to my husband who was up in Cairns at that point, like trying to like take these needles in my belly myself to try and like, you know, put us in a position to potentially have our own children. And so after the one round, I was like, you know what, it's, I don't really want to do this. It took me like 4 months to kind of shake that for my system. It just took me a bit after, not until like maybe April or May that following year that I felt, which was a few months after that, I felt completely like normal again. So we decided not to do another round because we were unsuccessful in falling pregnant in that one round. But we were told, like I said, that 2 or 3 rounds would probably be the most success, if anything. So that's okay. Put that on the back burner. I was like, that's right. Olympics is next year, just keep training, not a problem. Olympics postponed, we weren't to know. But I mean, I've got no regrets, it happened for a reason, and because of that treatment, I actually started to get a regular period for the first time in my life. So I don't know if that helped bring it on or it was going to happen anyway, I don't know, but that's the only thing I did differently, so I'm putting it down to that treatment. And yeah, I started getting a regular period every 5 or 6 weeks, and now a few years on, it's every like 4 or 5 weeks. And I remember the first natural period I had, it was very painful. I'd never experienced that pain because I was on the pill for my whole life, pretty much. And then I didn't bleed for 4 years. So when I rang my specialist and I was like, is this normal? Oh my gosh. He's like, ah, yes, that's what it feels like when you ovulate. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. So it's been interesting, like in my later years, to really experience a natural period for the first time. And for the last few years, it's been really great. But I'm also really happy. And I mean, whether that means I don't need to do this treatment again, I have some extra tests that I need to do probably following the World Cup just to, you know, make sure all my eggs and stuff are okay, because being 33, just want to make sure. A few years back, 2 years ago, they were all good. He was happy with where they were at. So, but you know, that's just a part of what we have to do as females. But as an athlete, I'd love to go one more go at an Olympic Games in Paris in 2024. And then maybe after that, I'll stop and try and have my own babies. So at that stage, Pearl will be about 2. So it'd be perfect timing. But this certainly gives me a taste, a really good taste of motherhood.
It's fitting. George is about to have a daughter. She's passionate about gender equality in sport.
I hope that the only way is up from here, that we don't take any more backward steps and we just completely just go this way, and that there's really no more steps backwards. And that by the time, I've got a younger sister, she just turned 15, and by the time that she comes through the senior ranks, if that's, you know, what she decides to do and pushes hard and works hard to get to, then, you know, it's even better for her in all areas. There's such a huge equality piece that we're still grinding for every single day. As women, and then women athletes on top of that, you know, as well. Pay gap, it's real, and we grind every single day. We're out on the floor, we're doing the same, if not working harder, and we you know, I think it's 27% of the rookie NBL salary is what we get in the WNBL for the minimum salary, so there's a long way to go. For us as female athletes, like, that's an element of what we do. We play for our country, we grind it out, we try and win championships for our club, of course it's our job, we get paid, but there's the grind element of it as well, at all times, because we're always trying to be seen, we're always trying to remind people we're here, we're always trying to remind people we're not a joke, and that women's sport matters, and that we can play, and that we are as good as the men. We do have high IQ, you know, it's always a battle.
That was Australian Open basketballer Taylor George, ending that story from Amanda Shalala. And that about brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. A reminder of the top stories for today as President Joe Biden prepares to host a White House summit with Pacific leaders. Solomon Islands is already making it clear it won't sign up to a proposed new PAC. It has dealt a blow to the U.S. in its efforts to improve relations with Pacific Island nations. And we also heard out of Papua New Guinea, a senior government minister and the National Police Force have launched a scathing attack on Australia's anti-corruption credentials in the Pacific and has accused Australia of harbouring an alleged fraudster in Cairns. If you want to catch up on any other stories that you heard today or in the previous few days, you can do so by just logging into our website. That's abc.net.au/Pacific. You can also find us on all the usual social media platforms on Facebook and Twitter at ABC Pacific. Do get in touch. Tell us what you think of the show, any stories that you want us to follow, or any music that you want to hear played on the show. I'll be back tomorrow morning, same time. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. Do join me then. Until then, though, have a lovely day.